The following content is provided under a Creative Commons license. Your support will help MIT OpenCourseWare continue to offer high-quality educational resources for free. To make a donation or view additional materials from hundreds of MIT courses, visit MIT OpenCourseWare at ocw.mit.edu.
Welcome back. Thanks for not dropping the class yet.
Oh, I gotta do that right now.
Funny you mention that. Just a reminder, actually, the one big reminder for folks who weren't here on Friday is that we swapped around Friday and Mondays.
Yeah, the 17th and the 20th have been swapped.
Yeah.
In terms of readings and what we're going to do in class.
Yeah. So we're still going to be playing the games on Friday, but the brainstorming activity that we had scheduled for Monday is going to be on this Friday instead, and then flip around otherwise. So, anyone manage to get through the readings? Cool. Let's see, where should we start? So there was a Doug Church article, which was on Gama Sutra, and if you're familiar with Gama Sutra, it's or if you're not, actually, it's a fairly well-read news and industry, sort of industry news blog for the game industry, but largely the digital game industry. That particular article, I think, was originally written not for the website, but for the magazine that the associated company publishes, which is the Game Developer Magazine. And Doug Church is actually an MIT alum. Him and the other article that was read, Mark Lund, are both actually MIT alums. So that's one thing that so Doug Church proposes a set of tools. Anyone remember what they're called?
The four live strikes.
The fat team. And Mark's framework, which is
MAD.
And we kind of covered mechanics and dynamics on Friday, and today we have a little bit of time to talk about aesthetics. But the reason why these two essays were kind of put right next to each other was NDA is an example of what Doug Church was describing as formalized rank design tool. In fact, at the time when NDA came out, it was pretty much the only one that caught on. All of the problems that Doug Church lays out in his article about the problems that we don't have a vocabulary, that consistent vocabulary to talk about our craft, and thus we can't actually improve on it, and thus we need some formal tools to that everyone uses. Unfortunately, not much has caught up. MDA being one of the few that has. Because for a number of different reasons. First of all, it actually is a useful framework. You know, you can think of many, many ways to formally look at games, but from a designer, you need to think of something that you can actually apply to help improve your games. And MDA actually gives you a reason why design is hard. So if nothing else, designers like it a lot because it says, this is why my job is hard. And the reason being, you get to control the mechanics. But that's not what you're going for. You're not going for really interesting mechanics. You're going for a really interesting aesthetic. You're going for a fun, engaging play experience. There are, in the MDA paper, this 18 kinds of fun. And I've asked him about this when he gave this presentation here in MIT. Those 8 were not meant to be comprehensive. They were meant to be, these are the 8 that I could think of at the time. And IDOS, I have a list somewhere where IDOS has like a full page of different kinds of fun. Different kinds of experiences that people are trying to get out of playing games. That's what a game designer is trying to get. The only problem is that a game designer doesn't actually control that experience. The game designer only gets to control the mechanics. Depending on what company you are, maybe you have the title of game designer, but you're also in charge of the art. You're also the lead programmer. It's possible that you also have more control over things than just the mechanics. But most designers, mechanics is what their job scope is. So they write the rules. The rules interact in some sort of like ridiculously hard to predict way, and then you get the experience of playing the game, the aesthetic. And you hope that's what you're going for. It usually isn't. And then you make a change to the mechanics, try again. And the nice thing about that is that that works really well with iterative design. In fact, without iterative design, it becomes really hard to control this entire process, because basically you are two orders removed from the experience that you're trying to create. It's like, you know, trying to draw on a piece of paper where not only can you not see the paper that you're drawing on, you're also, you know, controlling the brush or the pencil, you know, tied to a stick or something like that. Life of it. That's kind of what being a game designer is like. So that's the experience from the game design side. You get to control the mechanics, and you're going for some sort of aesthetic. And from the other side, the player is experiencing some kind of aesthetic, and you know, and they can sort of work their way back. You know, it's like, I'm getting this kind of experience. Why am I getting this kind of experience? You know, if you've got a particularly insightful game player, maybe you're taking CMS 300 Introduction to Video Games and you're analyzing games, and you're trying to say, how did we get here? And you know, if you're taking this class, you're going to be doing that a lot. You know, this game, Heroes of Might and Magic 3, for instance, you know, has give me a particularly a sensation. Describe the sensation that you got when you were playing that game, that you recall.
Strategic. Outsmarting. So playing against friends. Outsmart them.
So it made you feel smart. It made you have to think really, really hard and everything. So, and then you think about what dynamics might have resulted in that. You know, what sort of
fog of war.
Fog of war. You have to figure out what is behind the areas you can't see.
Yeah.
But then there's some information that you can see that may give you clues. And then, you know, fog of war might actually be already a mechanic, but you know, the idea of there is information that you can deduce even though you can't actually see it, and you have some probability of getting it right based on your experience with the game. Fog of war being one game mechanic that gets you there. So you can sort of analyze it backwards and figure out, okay, that's one thing fog of war gets you. Sometimes fog of war just confuses people, right? That could be anything behind this corner. I mean, technically, Final Fantasy random combat system is like Fog of War, right? I don't know if there's a random encounter here. I will walk into it, and then, oh look, there's slimes of Dragon Quest.
That was Tenet Slimes. Hmm? Really? Didn't Final Fantasy Tenet Slimes?
The Square Enix merger is complete.
Plans are the classic Final Fantasy ones. Slimes are the classic Dragon Quest ones.
Mm-hmm. Slimes.
Yeah. You are fighting cake. But there is actually a problem. Actually, I don't need to write this down. There is a problem with, it's not a problem. There is an issue that I have with formal abstract design tools and comes with the word formal. Doug Church uses it specifically to say, well, it should be sort of serious business, right? You know, it's formal with a capital F. We're not talking about how cool this game is. You know, we want to be very precise in our vocabulary. We want to be, you know, we want to treat it like serious business, capital S, capital B. However, the other assumption with the word formal comes from formalism. You are thinking about the form of the game in a way that if you were trying to apply the same technique to talk about art, you'd be talking about the form of visual art, you know, the form of cinema. And that is actually a fairly narrow way to look at something which at a topic that's as broad as a game. It is as if we were trying to analyze something like Heroes Might Have Met, and completely ignoring the fact that you were playing it with friends from French class. You know, that would be an example of, well, that had nothing to do with the game. Well, actually, it probably had a lot to do with how you experienced the game. Playing, there's the rules of chess, and you can just look at the game based on its rules of the rules of chess. You could also look at the history of chess. You could also look at who you're playing it against. Are you playing against random person or against your dad? You know, big difference. Or in my case, my mom. Are you playing it in a club? Are you playing it, you know, against the chess master in Harvard Square or something like that? what does this game mean? Are you using the game metaphorically in speech, or you know, just saying and I had, you know, and my opponent was in a checkmated position. Does it necessarily mean that you were playing chess with your with someone else in order to get that point across? And there's a whole range of different ways that you can look at games, even as a game designer, that isn't specifically formalist. That isn't specifically just looking at the form of the game. Just understanding what context people are going to be playing the game in, for instance. So for a lot of the games that you guys are going to be designing this semester, specifically in this class, you know, you have to think about the fact that a lot of these games are actually going to be played by your instructors, are going to be played in a setting very similar to this by your colleagues in this room, are probably going to end up being tested by dorm mates, you know, fraternity friends, folks around campus, and all that is going to heavily influence the kind of game that you make. Now, for better or worse, you know, you are pretty much making a game for an MIT audience. And we're trying to change that a little bit for the last assignment. But keep in mind that, you know, you have to be, that's not necessarily every single game that you're going to make in the future. And that shouldn't be. But knowing that, you can try to cater to the audience that you've got for everything else. That has very little, I mean, in some ways, this is going to affect the design decisions that you're making in the game. What will be perfectly acceptable to a competitive MIT audience might not be perfectly acceptable to your average board game buyer in Target or something like that, and vice versa. And so what may be a perfectly engrossing game mechanic, dynamic, aesthetic experience that you will get, but just by looking at the formal aspects of a game, you know, this will be really cool if you understood the mechanic, played it out in the way that created the desired dynamic to give you the aesthetic experience. But if you don't understand the context that you're playing the game, as an example, then your player may not even get that far. Your player may look at your game and say, this game is not for me, and just walk away. It might mean that you might... I'm thinking of things like, we just had this discussion over lunch about social games that you find on Facebook. And a lot of social games, I might have already made this point, but it has been argued that social games aren't all that social. All you do is really beg and spam your friends. That's the whole point of playing a game. But in many ways, it's also saying to your friends, we're kind of doing the same thing. You know, we may be separated by time and separated by distance, but we're all doing the same thing. And we could be playing this game, we could be talking about a show that we are watching in our own apartments, but then we get to discuss it. But in many ways, this is just me telling you we're doing the same thing, therefore we're part of the same group. And that serves a function that has almost, that really doesn't have anything to do with the formal analysis of how a game mechanic works. But it's still incredibly crucial to the popularity of this game. So keep that in mind that even Dr. Church makes this point, but I think a lot of designers actually kind of ignore that when you read his essay, that it's only one set of tools. The formal tools are only one set of tools, even. There are tools at looking at games culturally, personally, and other things that you may get in this class and in classes like CMS 300, that will affect it, how people experience a game and how much pleasure they're going to get a game, to understand whether your game is doing what it does, right? That don't have anything to do necessarily with just by looking at the self-contained system of the game. Just as a side note, how many of you folks have heard of the narrative versus ludology debate? How many of you are sick of this? I'm sick of it too, but I bring it up for one reason. There is an interesting case that if you actually look at narratology as a study and ludology as a study, they're both formalist studies. And in fact, they're more accurate, more precise, they're both structuralist, which is kind of, if you look at philosophies, it's kind of a subset of formalism, or at least a more recent version of it. They're both basically focused on, these are the elements of this art form, and this is how they interact to produce some sort of effect. And all that matters is what's contained in this art form. What's outside this art form doesn't matter. That's what narratology does for stories. That's what ludology does for games. That's, in fact, probably why most people who study games have kind of walked away from ludology, because it's not that interesting. You just study what's inside the system. People want to see what's outside. So when you compare structuralist against structuralist, structuralism wins. That's one case. And you may not realize that you're actually looking at your game through a very, very narrow lens. So try to broaden the range of tools that you've got. You know, this class is going to give you a small set of them, and it's not by any means the be-all and end-all of every single way that you can look at it, at the game. And then they're not just restricted to the tools that are specifically teaching you in this class. So keep looking out for all the new ones. Let's see. Any questions so far? That was my rant. 10 minute rant? 15 minutes? Okay, all right, no more ranting. All right, we have a activity, and do you want to run through?
Yeah. Okay, so I'm going to pass around. This is my crappy race game. So you're going to need one copy per pair. There's also some nifty set of dice. You need one copy per, or one die per pair. And then each person is going to need three of these poker chips. It doesn't matter what they are, so just grab three. And then you're each going to need a marker to indicate yourself, and I recommend describing any given die you like. There should be more than enough for your copy.
You
only need one board per group.
One die for every two people?
Yeah, one of the six-sided die for the two. And then you need markers for yourselves and then bonus markers. And that's what the poker chips are for. So keep the poker chips circulating.
Three per person.
One playing piece per person.
Okay. You can use coins, you can use dice, like six-sided dice, scraps of paper, whatever you want.
I am in Mako with the penny and the crown.
So we have three of these.
Most people see that.
How many accords do you take that?
If you need markers for yourself, you can try one of the multi-sided polyhedral things. I guess both of those free.
Okay, what now?
I should have used this. I'm more well-versed in the board.
I concede defeat. Is that even correct English?
No. Cool.
I think you're going to have to die just to roll. The die is to roll. Yeah.
So, yeah.
Okay, if you want to get back, I think where I can get more stuff that we need. Okay, so can everyone hold on for a second? So what we're going to ask you to do is just play through this game a couple times, and then we're going to come back and kind of apply the MGA framework to the game itself. And then if we have time, I think we're going to spend some time tweaking it.
Yeah.
Okay, cool. So we'll interrupt you in probably 10 minutes. Actually, 10 minutes is probably wrong. It's a pretty quick game.
Okay, so I mean,
this is sort of on the fly.
Yeah.
So what we kind of like to do is hear about. I guess we'll just go around the room in pairs, and you guys can talk. Or do you want a minute to talk about to apply MGA to this and kind of come up with something, so I'm not like calling on you on the spot?
Anybody want to volunteer what, how they felt? What was the aesthetic of this game?
There is none.
Well, that's not true. People were pretty loud for their
advertising itself as crappy race game.
It felt competitive.
Well, the thing is, it's like very simple aesthetic. So in the paper they say you're going to go straight, like the player should be using the aesthetic, but here you go straight to the mechanic and you're wondering about it.
Yeah. It definitely is easy, especially for board games, because the mechanics are written down right in front of you. It's really easy for you to judge. But how did you feel while you were playing this game?
I think there was a sense of tension. There was maybe a sense of brinkmanship, perhaps. There was a sense of, like there was the intellectual challenge of working out, like is there really a meaningful decision to be made here? And if there is, like, what is the correct decision?
So just put in the mind of, like, can I optimize this?
Especially
for this crowd, I think there's immediate assumption. Can I figure out what the right way to play this? And I know you tried to figure it out.
I think he correctly
figured it out. So is there an optimal way to play this game?
Yeah. Okay. So if you're losing, you're gonna, if you keep putting tokens down, you're gonna lose anyway. So you want to be rolling in order to, like, increase the variance. And if you're winning, you want to be putting tokens down in order to remove the variance. You can imagine it's like a distribution. Whereas if you're, like, below, if you're, like, below the winning line, you want to, like, widen it out as much as possible, so as much of the distribution is above the winning line. And if you're above the winning line, you want to be as narrow as possible, so you stay above the winning
line. So your strategy is basically based on what's the current state of the game?
Yeah, until, like, the last turn, where obviously you don't want to put a token down if you're two from the end. like, as long as no one can win on this turn, if I'm behind him, I'm putting down, I'm rolling the die, and if I'm ahead of him, I'm putting down a token.
Did anyone, like, prefer a strategy before you started thinking about what was the best approved?
So I was too lazy to use the token, so I would just keep rolling.
But that's also part of the aesthetic of it, right? It's like you just happen to prefer the die roll.
Yeah, well, in the first six spaces, I mean, you should be getting the average if you roll on the same if you put the token down. I personally like being conservative.
You win no matter what.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
That's true. See, and so that's...
That is,
I'm sorry, go ahead.
But that is more exciting because it does different things.
If the token gives you the illusion
that
you're actually
Did anyone, like, get to a situation where, like, really far behind and just, like, caught up?
No.
Really quickly?
No.
You can't. The tokens that in one turn, the person is all the tokens. Like, shoot.
Right. Like, the actual difference, one of the things that you do get in this game is sort of perceived distance between players is actually, you know, not that far. If the one behind actually has to, then I think people refer to this as the American Gladiators effect.
Yeah.
You know how, like, American Gladiators, is this your example that I'm stealing?
I don't remember.
Okay.
Honestly,
it's someone's example that I'm stealing. But
I think it's in the book at some point. We had applied it to this.
Plagiarism. Okay.
Yes. Well, I'm crediting someone for this, but I wish I could
say citation
needed. The basic idea being, you know, who's seen American Gladiators or
it might be too old.
I don't know what it is.
Okay, there are also a number of different, like, Japanese game shows, which are kind of similar to this.
You guys seen the Japanese game shows?
Yeah. The basic idea in American Gladiators is that it's basically an obstacle course where the obstacles are people. Happen to be kind of these, like, athletic dudes and women who have... who are either pummeling you with buffer sticks or, like, shooting tennis balls at you out of a gun and stuff like that. And you basically have to get from the beginning to the end faster than the other team. Actually, faster than the other player. So it's two regular dudes, a whole bunch of athletes who are throwing things at you. every time you get hit, you have to go back a little bit. But the thing about American Gladiators is that, so you have this long obstacle course,
In fact, this was one of the events. This was always the final event of the entire TV show. Is that you will have two people doing the same course. They will have to climb up a wall, and then they will have to go down a zip line. Yeah.
But it was like a cargo net specifically, so it was really difficult to climb up it.
Yeah, it was like this big webbing kind of thing. If you ever try it, and it's like climbing the rigging of a ship, right? You know, it's like really, really difficult to get your feet on grabbing things. So what happens is that, you know, if you have two people who are really, really far apart, one person way ahead, and that person starts climbing the cargo net, it takes that person forever to get to the end of the cargo net, because climbing up cargo net is really, really hard, no matter who you are. That gives the person behind plenty of time to catch up and start climbing the cargo net. But then the person who was in the lead in the first place hits the zip line, and all of a sudden there's a huge increase of distance. So this whole idea that they never really were all that far, they never really changed their position for most gladiators games. The winner's already been decided by that point, because first person who reaches the cargo net tends to win the match. But it looks like the lead just shrank, because suddenly you've got both of them in one camera shot. And then you get that huge relief. That Mark likes to call that dramatic tension, which I think is a better description than his other term for the same thing, which is drama, because it's not drama. It's just tension release, really. But that's an aesthetic, you know, going for that aesthetic of tension and coming up with a game that makes you feel like a fight is closer than it actually is, or, you know, or allowing someone to close the gap really, really quickly, because as many of you have pointed out, these things probabilistically mean exactly the same thing as a die roll. Let's see. So that's, you know, but the ability to, you know, increase for a gap to open up and then to close, that's actually a dynamic. That's actually a result of a number of different rules that are in this particular game. And it's not written down that that's going to happen. But it's pretty much going to happen if you have two people playing those particular strategies. And it's one thing that happens pretty often. So that's one thing to keep in mind. What are the constraints that you're seeing in the design of this game here? Like what was this game, what did this game have to do in order for it to be a viable in-class exercise?
Fit on a sheet of paper,
that's a huge one actually. Because first of all, it limits how many spaces you've got. Assuming everyone's using like something this size or a coin or something.
You can laugh at that, but that's literally how it went, is I wanted it to fit on a sheet of paper, and the spaces had to accommodate a die. So the number of spaces is a result of that.
So 12 was probably an accident?
Yeah.
Well, you probably could have fit 13 square in there if you wanted
probably,
to.
But, you know, actually some margins.
Yeah, you're saying it's hard.
See, the rules have to fit on a sheet of paper as well, so the rules can't be that complicated.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Most of these rules are single sentences for the most part. It's just because your columns are so small, they look really not complicated. It has to be quick. It had to work for 10 minutes. In fact, it had to work so that you could get a few games hopefully through within 10 minutes. Did anyone only manage to get through one? Yeah. Okay.
That'd be really hard.
This is a little epic game.
So different aesthetics. So you know, this game tries to get it like really, really tense, but you know, obviously the decision that you're actually making in this game, you know, is minimal. You do get to say, well, if you are already losing, then there's really only one rational. One rational thing to do. But if you were playing this game, as Jason recommended, if I was playing this game against myself, you know, there really is no optimal strategy. I could pick two different strategies for each side.
Just because that who plays first, basically.
Yeah.
The person who plays first is by default win.
on average.
Game but one. I'm bad at rolling dice.
As if you roll enough, right? You could just be bad.
So I would like actually folks to try mixing this up a little bit. You know, pick a rule in here, any rule, and alter it. You know, either you can do things like adding more squares. You can change the movement chart. One idea that I had, and someone who's taken probability more recent than me, which is what happens if you use the high of two dice rolls instead of just one, you know, because that changes the probability. And play around with that, see what that feels like. And if that feels just boring, try changing something else. So we've got 15 minutes.
Yeah, that's reasonable.
Yeah, and then you'll tell the class about what you changed and how that changed the feeling of the game.
Cool.
So every two people work with the team next to you. Explain how your game, how your version works, and have the other group play it. And what I'm going to do after and vice versa. And what we're going to do once everyone's done this is. You will have to tell the class what you felt that game, the other group's game felt like. So let someone else figure out what your game aesthetic is. Cool. So does any team want to just go first? Describe the other team's game. Okay, just starting with you.
Do you want to like describe the rules they changed? The main change in this version was that it's modular, so you have to land exactly on the end, or otherwise you wrap around.
Okay.
it changed the aesthetic a lot because it stopped being like a race against your opponent and became more of like a trying to figure out how you can use your tokens to like precision just hit the end.
Oh,
very mathematical and like methodical. You just like you decided whether or not you're gonna stockpile tokens, give you more like winning squares. And then you just waited until you landed on a winning score.
So you get into this computational mode.
It's not as like competitive.
So one of the discussions we had was whether or not you had three tokens, you would just get to the end because we made our tokens so you would move four spaces.
Okay.
But I just realized you have to do the die roll after that.
Yeah.
So
Anyway. So let's see.
They had a really creative rule where they have a D10 here, so it goes from 0 to 9, and you roll it under a cup, and that's the number of spaces away from the end, so from 0 to 9 that the winning point is, and in your turn you can either play normally, or you can check to see where the winning point is. If you've won, that triggers you winning, but you cannot win until you physically check and confirm that you won. So it eats up a turn, but it could be that after one roll, like, or two rolls of two, and if this was a 9, you've won. Mm-hmm. And so there's and that was a lot of fun, basically, because we had to get figured out the optimal strategy, but it was just fun. Yeah, it was
really cool. So what does it feel like when you're, like, when you're trying to figure out what you're going to do?
He beat me by checking when it was far away, being lucky.
So if you don't check, you have to reach the end to win. So you have to check usually anyway in that game.
So one thing which I had in mind when we were thinking about the rule was that there ought to be information that you can get from how your opponent reacts after they look under the cup. So like if they then go and start rolling again or what have you, or they then like stockpile chips or something. I don't know.
Well, I mean, obviously,
but there must be an ability, some way that you can get leaked information from their behavior, which makes it kind of interesting in a different way.
If you have already seen the cup and you get past the point, do you have to check to win?
There are two different variants. One way you did, one way you didn't.
I see.
Well, you don't have to check the second time. If you check the first time, then you pass it, you win.
So that was one way of playing.
So the person who checks could win even if both of them are past the point. Am I understanding?
Well, so if he's the first past the point, the way that we're doing it is if you don't have to check to fit to win, so if you just need the knowledge of what the end point is, then if he passes it first, he wins. If when he checks, both players are at that spot, it's a tie. But since it's a sequential game, it's impossible, other than at the moment of the check, if both players are the same spot, it's impossible for them to end on at the same time, so that's not really an issue.
What if I check and you're past me and you have passed the checks part?
I don't win.
Okay.
Because I never checked. So as long as I don't know, I don't win.
That immediately makes me think of a different variant, but okay, oh yeah. Okay, cool.
So what they did was they introduced a couple new rules. The first rule being that the person who rolls first, on their first turn, they cannot put down a token. So they actually have to roll. The second rule is, whenever you roll, if you have a bonus, a token on the stockpile, you have two options after you roll. One is you can take it off and move two spaces like normal. The second is you can choose to make that block impassable. And so what this does is, you cannot, your opponent cannot land that block. If they are already on that block, they get pushed one block back. If they are behind it, they roll and they move to that block, they get pushed one block behind it.
So they're changing the map while you're playing.
Yes.
And how that feels while you're actually playing.
We didn't actually use that much.
It felt like a rule.
I felt like the penalty for the impassable block should have been more. Because if you land on the block that they're on and make them move back one, that token would otherwise have made you move forward too. Mm. So it doesn't really reward you for that. I feel like if it could have been really awesome if the penalty was like significantly more severe. Because it's hard to like get in front of them enough to actually make a block impassable and have them land on it later.
Probably just all the way back or something.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
So yeah, you know, try multiplying it by two and see what happens.
Yeah.
Well, even two is not fair. Even going back two is not fair.
Three.
You can
just go 2-4.
Yeah. Yeah, and then you're not always going to land on it.
Yeah. If you're like, that should have changed the gameplay, but that didn't. One of the tricks in chapter one was, you know, just make it bigger and see what happens. You know, if nothing else, it will just give you more information on, you know, whether you should be spending any more time with this direction, or whether it, you know, it really isn't going to affect the way how people play because people don't end up caring about it. So the rule of two is just like multiply something by two or halve it by two and see what happens. Obviously, halving by two will not work so well. Okay. Who else?
Yep. So essentially, they had these tokens as power-ups, and you would never actually take them off to move more spaces. You would just keep adding tokens, and you could roll. So you could spend one turn to put a token on, and then consequent rolls, you could essentially say, I have n tokens, so therefore I roll n plus one dice and subtract n.
N plus one dice. So I have three tokens.
And then you roll a die for each token you have, right. And then move back one space for each token you have.
Interesting.
So it moves your average and your maximum up each time.
Right. So you could add tokens to power yourself up.
And you could also remove tokens to take away tokens from the other guy, right?
Yeah.
Okay, so
which
we
never actually did.
We were playing it wrong.
Oh, <right. laughs> I think we didn't realize. I guess we forgot to go over the fact that you don't take out all the tokens when you do your special move. They stay in there. Because mathematically speaking, if you take them off, it's just worse.
It's a better roll.
Right. So I mean, well, that's an important object lesson in how to explain your rules to other people. But you know, how did it feel while you were playing there, Baron?
It made my mind tired, being like n plus one minus n, blah blah. But it was interesting. I actually used it. Like before, I said that I would only use the die, but this time I actually used tokens.
And what happened when you actually used the token? Was it like yes?
Like I said, like the math made it too hard for me to actually.
Well, something happened. Okay. Well, it made you use the tokens as opposed to
it was interesting. It.
Okay, cool. Who has any?
So the rule that they gave was that if you are behind the player, by behind they mean if your token, if your piece is like behind the other one, not like
in losing second place.
Right.
Yeah.
but not in the imaginary sense. In the
If
you're physically behind them, then when you use a token, you get to move one extra space ahead.
Okay. If you use two tokens, you end up getting like
still
one.
You still one space.
So how that feel?
It actually changed the strategy a little bit because in the beginning you basically don't want to be the person who moves first because then your opponent can just use all their tokens and get a lot further ahead.
Mm. Oh, I see.
That's interesting.
Okay, so.
maybe you want to stockpile tokens and then wait for the other player to get ahead of you so that you can reuse them. You can
exactly.
Yeah,
even
exactly.
Further.
Yeah.
Yeah. Then you just sit at the start line of three tokens.
Yeah, right.
But then you're forced to roll.
So pretty much the person goes second.
So that's actually a negative feedback loop, which we'll get to, I guess, in the next class. But the whole idea being, if there is a gap between players and you have game mechanics that specifically are designed to narrow the gap, those are negative feedback loops. You know,
Mario Kart.
Mario Kart's blue shell is the other direction, right? Is to knock back the person who's leading rather than helping them catch up. Actually, a lot of Mario Kart's mechanics are basically designed at trying to reduce the lead. All right, cool. Who has it on? Yeah.
So they add one roll, keeping everything else equal. They add a second die, and then the way it worked was you arbitrarily assign people odd or even numbers, and then you'd roll to see who would go on that particular turn.
Oh.
And then that person, whoever it was assigned to, would play. And then you would roll again to see who went at the next turn, and so forth and so forth.
How that feels.
I got bad memories of Mario Kart.
It's like what again?
Boy, I many mechanics I just describe as great Mario Kart like phenomenon.
Well, Mario Kart is actually a collection of a lot of fairly fundamental mechanics, but. You know, describe specifically.
I felt like just rolling to see who won, like amplified the sense that you were playing for luck.
So it amplified the randomness, basically.
Yeah, which I actually detest personally.
Well, so
that rule
is the original game.
Yeah, that rule is like the initiative rule in Star Wars miniatures and Dungeons and Dragons miniatures. And like in that case, where there's like actual strategic decisions to be made, then it's actually kind of cool because it means that you never know like whether you're going to be able to capitalize on the position that you're in at the end of the turn.
That's exactly what I was saying. It's like, since we both know optimal strategy for the original game, now it's just throw a lot.
So
if there was a harder strategy, it'd be pretty cool.
So it almost becomes like a gambling game, a game of chance. Cool. Alright.
They added different dice you could roll for different effects. Such as if you rolled a d20, you could go 10 spaces if you managed to get a 17, 18, 19.
Or 18, 19, 20.
Or 18, 19, 20, yeah. And they added the d10, which also had similar effects, and the d8. So Patrick and I pretty much experimented with, well, he just rolled a d20 the entire time. And I experimented with rolling the d8 and the d10.
And
you just choose which one you were.
Yeah, and you use a d6 as well.
Why would you not roll?
Why would you not roll?
Yeah. I started feeling impatient. Like I would forget everything about Alec and what he wanted to do, and every turn I would roll the d20, hoping to get 18, 19, or 20.
By the way, and with the d20, if you don't roll any of those, you go zero spaces.
Yeah.
So that's actually the
reason.
Oh.
So you could either win the game or go nowhere.
Roll the communication.
I would roll the d20 waiting to get 18, 19, or 20, and not until I rolled the 18, 19, 20 would I care where he was on the board.
So it comes you and the dice. It's just you and the randomness.
I won like twice.
No, I won twice too.
Yeah. They're with equal chances.
Which was slightly different. I mean, like what you described earlier is that, you know, whether you're behind or in front of someone changed the way that you would play in the original version. This one now no longer really matters anymore, right? It's just you and the dice. And if the universe loves you, you would just automatically win.
Well, the intention was to have the d20 there if you were like way behind, and the other ones if you were only slightly behind. But apparently, that's not how it was.
Well,
good thing we have iterative design, right?
Well, it's a great example of the aesthetic you were going for, not necessarily being the aesthetic that was actually experienced. So, you know. It's still a powerful aesthetic, it's just a different thing than what you. I think I might have skipped you guys.
Yes.
Yeah, sorry about that.
So their new rule was if you're physically ahead and you roll a 6, instead of only going 3, you go 4.
If you're physically ahead and you roll a 6, you go. Oh, okay.
Okay.
Ooh, positive.
Yeah.
Positive.
Ooh. So, exact opposite from.
Yeah, so at first we tried playing it in a similar way to how we did before, and it really felt like the person who was ahead even more. And it involved with everyone rolling, because as soon as you roll, you get a higher expectation value.
So you are more you will prefer to go for luck rather than the
So the problem is, if you put a token down, then they're guaranteed, they roll at least a one, so you're guaranteedly going to be behind, and then they have a higher expectation.
So but how does it feel? Sure, mathematically that's what it means, but
yeah,
actually roll it.
Actually, in play in the first game, I don't think it actually came up at all. Mm-hmm. So, and then in the second game, I believe it did, and
yeah,
it, to me, it didn't really feel like it changed.
I don't know. For me, the entire time, I felt like the person who was ahead was more ahead.
It would come up more if your board was longer.
Yeah.
Because you're only encouraged to stockpile for the first few turns. But if you're encouraged more, then you might want to switch. It's contrary to
something. Even in games where no one rolled a six, do you feel like it changed your strategy?
Yes.
Because overall,
it changed.
It made rolling feel like a better thing to do. So which was the point, right? That was what you guys were aiming for.
Yeah, the alternate rule that we had toyed with was that if you are ahead and you put down a token, you have to roll, and if you get a sick, you have to move one step back. So like a 1 in 6 chance of there being a penalty for the token, because precisely what you mentioned, which is that when you're ahead, the dominant strategy basically is to reduce the variance. We just toyed with stuff to make you want to roll more, basically.
So dynamically, that tells you roll more. I think I would say aesthetically, you have the whole monopoly situation of the person who's winning keeps winning, that's, you know, there are times when you actually want that feeling, especially when it came to the game of Monopoly. The whole point of the game was huge financial imbalances, and then it's like, wow, I have no money and I'm just going to keep losing money. That was the point of the game, actually. That's why it's called Monopoly.
So the amusing thing with that is that the person who's physically ahead might actually be ahead in terms of absolute gameplay, because the other person may have stockpiled tokens.
Mm-hmm.
And we weren't sure whether determining who was ahead by counting the tokens in the equation or not was a better game rule, but we didn't have enough time to test.
Give it a shot after test. The one that we came up with was, at first we thought it wouldn't change the game at all, I guess, which is basically, instead of spending tokens to go forward 2 steps, you spend the token to knock your opponent back 2 steps.
Ooh. That changed the game.
Yeah. Completely changed the gameplay.
We tried that. It sucks.
It really changed it.
What happened is, like, you stockpile first, and then you knock people back, and so, like, you didn't go anywhere for the first, like, 10 turns, and you realize that nothing was going to happen,
and then
so
we just kept rolling
roll the rest of the time.
Which is a completely different way to play the game. That whole process of stockpiling right at the beginning is, I mean, sure, we could have both started with a stack of 3 each, because that's really what happens 3 turns in. but the whole act of like, that felt really like, okay, clearly you are setting up to kill me. So.
Could you move very neutral
from the start?
Huh?
Can you move?
No. Okay. We had it so that it wouldn't be any point spending it when you were right at the beginning. But there was that whole arms race deal that really didn't happen in this game. All it did really was make the game longer.
Yeah.
But it felt mean. Okay. That's pretty much it for today, I guess.
Yeah.
So, cool.
And we need the poker chips and all the dice back, but you can keep the game boards if you're really happy.
Yes! How long did this game take you to make?
It took longer to make the board than to make the rules.
Yeah, I just announced
as illustrated.
I don't know, it's a Word document.